Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 22nd Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today's guest speaker will be American biographer T.J. Stiles, author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War, and, most recently, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. He'll speak on the topic, It Happened Here, Why National Conflicts Have Centered on the Great Plains. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 3, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Humanities Nebraska, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor, the Honorable Pete Ricketts.
It has been mentioned it's our sesquicentennial year. And so it's a great opportunity for us to reflect on the great history and culture that we have here in Nebraska. And we're going to have a great lecture here tonight by T.J. Stiles. You know, one of the things we've been able to do over the past year is think about our great heroes that we have here in Nebraska and all the great history. And that we're going to be talking a little bit about conflict here tonight and why it centers on the Great Plains. But, you know, just some of the interesting things about Nebraska that I think are fascinating are that, for example, the first recorded battle in Nebraska was actually in 1720. It was a Spanish expedition that was coming up from Santa Fe and ran into a tribe of Pawnee who were encouraged, we think, to attack the Spanish expedition by French traders, because the French and the Spanish were fighting over what would become the Louisiana Territory. Fascinating history, because that attack discouraged the Spanish from really pressing any more claims into the middle part of this continent. And then, of course, we're going to talk a little bit about Custer's Trials, and that ties back to then the Plains Wars after the Civil War. And it's interesting, again, to note that Nebraska at that time was very dangerous, not just from the weather or natural disasters or accidents, but nearly 1,000 U.S. soldiers died in our state as a part of that. And we'll never know how many Native Americans, we'll probably never know how many Native Americans also died as part of that conflict. So it's really a good time for us to reflect upon our history. And I think that's one of the things that T.J. Stiles is going to really be able to help us do tonight with his lecture. His most recent book, which is Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America, has won a Pulitzer Prize in 2016. But that's actually not his first Pulitzer Prize. This is not his first rodeo, so to speak, on that aspect. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize back in 2010 for his book, The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. And he also won the National Book Award in 2009 for that very book. He's also written a book, Jesse James, The Last Rebel of the Civil War. So as you can see, he's got a great depth of knowledge with regard to American history and the types of topics that we're going to talk about here today. His background and pedigree include being a past fellow for the past Guggenheim Fellow, as well as Lerner-Giltner Fellow. He's been on the faculty of the World Economic Forum and has also just done a number of other things with regard to how he's looked at history. We were talking about it at our table tonight and talking about financial history, and the Union Pacific Railroad, which I don't think he's going to get into tonight. But he's got a deep depth of knowledge on those sort of things, so it's going to be fascinating. His education, actually, he's from rural Minnesota, and he went to Carleton College, where he earned a distinction in history before going on to get his Master's of Arts and Master's of Philosophy from Columbia University studying European history. He has lived in New York for 20 years, but more recently has moved to Berkeley, California, where he lives with his wife and two children. So I think we're in for a really great conversation tonight by someone who has a lot to offer us with regard to American history and Nebraska's unique place in it. So with that, please help me give a warm Nebraska welcome to T.J. Stiles.
Don't worry, I hadn't given up yet. Well, thank you very much. First of all, I should say happy birthday, Nebraska. It is a real honor to be invited to give this talk when Nebraska Humanities, and I also should say thank you for supporting Nebraska Humanities. This is such an important mission, and it plays such an important role in our public life that I really have to thank you on behalf of Nebraska Humanities. When they called and asked if I would give the governor's lecture in humanities, I said I would be honored. They said, can you cover 400 years in 40 minutes? I said, I'll call you back. And then I called back and I said, I tell you what, 300 years, but only a slice. So that's where we're at. And I want to talk about the idea of the Great Plains, Nebraska, and more widely speaking, the Great Plains, as being at the center of American history, not as a margin to history, even though margins play a role in the story, but at the center of American history and how Americans have argued about what the country is all about. Now, I want to start at a moment which is very familiar to me from writing my biography, June 1st, 1867, which found Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer in Nebraska at Fort McPherson, where he had marched from Kansas on his first campaign against Native Americans on the Great Plains. And there he met an Oglala leader named Pawnee Killer, whom he'd encountered before. Now, this meeting is one that really became, in many ways, a turning point in Custer's life, but also it comes at a key moment in the history of the Great Plains and the history of Nebraska. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back through the history of what led up to this moment from the perspective of both of these men, and then what led out of it. So I'm going to talk about not two individuals quite so much as two world systems. This is a term that goes back to the historian Emanuel Wallerstein, who had a whole scheme of history that is not what I'm talking about. The idea of framing the world, of how you understand the world, what are peoples, what are nations, what is diplomacy, how do we make use of nature? All of these ideas of how you understand the world, both of these men represented different world systems that were coexisting in the same place. And the Great Plains is where they came into collision. So let's go back hundreds of years to the moment when the Europeans, many moments, when the Europeans arrived in North America. Now, the Spanish arrived first. They came up from Mexico, of course, into New Mexico and California. The French came down the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes region. And the English, of course, landed on the Atlantic shore. But you notice that there is this large zone that they left largely unoccupied, the Great Plains, and in particular, the High Plains, the region west of the 100th Meridian. And this was an area that was an interstitial space not merely between empires, but also between native peoples as well and native nations. And the reason is that even though there were rich resources on the High Plains, they were hard to get at. There were prohibitions that kept people from exploiting those resources. And so native peoples ventured onto the plains, and people from those European empires ventured onto the plains, but they resisted human settlement. Now, that began to change around 1700, led by the Comanches. Now, the Comanches adopted the horse, and they began to, which they got from the Spanish to the south, and they began to develop what became the classic High Plains nomadic culture. And you see evidence of that in this village, in this great painting, Catlin painting, showing a village with those great lodges we call teepees, formed by the careful treatment and expert arrangement and development of buffalo hides. And they were found a way to exploit the great resource of bison herds on the plains. Of course, they were able to do this because of the horse. Both bison and the horse made use of this enormous energy resource on the plains, grasses. grasses were very huge resource, but they're very difficult to exploit, and you needed grazing animals to exploit them. The bison were an enormous resource that provided many, many benefits to the nations that hunted them. But again, they were hard to get at. Archaeologists have found elaborate traps that before the advent of the horse, native peoples had built to drive buffalo herds in and trap just a few. The native peoples of the eastern plains, including where we are today, Pawnees, Omahas, Osages, others, would venture onto the plains. But again, when they were footbound, they could only go so far and they could only hunt so much. So the horse really began to change this and allowed them to become a fully nomadic culture. And this culture, as I'll talk about in a moment, spread beyond the Comanches. Now, another thing that the horse allowed them to do was to become aggressors and to become, in fact, what one historian calls an imperial power in and of themselves. And they became great horsemen, starting with the Comanches, great mounted warriors. Now, this warfare is important to understand something about those nomadic peoples, which is they were enmeshed in relationships with their neighbors. The idea that as nomads, they were isolated from civilization, which is the way a lot of Americans wrote about them in the 19th century, is not true. In fact, the horse itself represents a global movement of livestock and technology. Those horses weren't merely from Spain. The Spanish brought them over. They were developed from North African breeds that had been bred specifically to be adapted to very arid, low-moisture conditions, which made them perfect for the Great Plains. And when that gentleman Custer gets back to the Great Plains, he later wrote about how the Indian pony is an insignificant variant of the equine species. You know, it was a little, scrawny little pony. And yet, it could subsist on grazing alone. And all of those northern European horses needed grain and hay to be able to survive. So they not only adopted the horse from the Spanish by raiding and by trade, they also were acquiring an African-derived horse, very suited to their environment. And what were they doing by expanding onto the plains? They were not only staking out space for themselves and seizing hunting grounds, but they were also motivated by commerce. The Comanches and then the other High Plains nations were trying to control trade routes. So they not only controlled trade between other Indian nations, they began to be the middlemen in trade between the European powers that came onto the North American scene. And the Comanches especially were very aggressive in controlling the trade that crossed their territory. So again, they have their own world system, and yet they're in contact with the European system. They're interacting with it. They're trading. They're warring. And this is not an isolated or ancient lifestyle, but one that was very dynamic and developed only in the 19th century. And again, that dynamism is important to remember when we think about just their simple movement. So we've got the Europeans, obviously, are moving into the interior of North America, but also Indians themselves are moving and seizing opportunities, warring with each other, and trying to exploit resources. So you have the Comanches who move out of the Rocky Mountains, and they move south and east, and they begin to stake out a space which Pekahamaylan calls the Comanche Empire on the southern plains. And they become the great middlemen between the Spanish of the south, who they raid and plunder, the French in Louisiana, the English, and then who become the Americans, as well as other native peoples. The Cheyennes move south from the Black Hills in the early 19th century, and they begin to occupy the middle ground, the middle plains, along with their allies, the Arapahos. And again, I'm just talking about some of the largest nations, where there's also Kiowas, Plains Apaches, Arapahos, other nations that were allies of these larger nations that are my focus. And the Lakotas, the Western Sioux, the seven tribes of the Lakotas, they move west out of Minnesota, out of the middle Missouri River territory, into the Black Hills, fighting against their neighbors. Now, my focus right now as I talk is about these High Plains peoples. But, of course, this is a story about their whole world. You've got, again, the Pawnees, the Osages, the Crows, Blackfeet, Utes, other nations which are in conflict with and struggling with the High Plains nations, who for a while are at war with themselves. And they are exploiting the and adapting to the environment that they're living in. So where we are now, it's in the low plains. It's a lusher environment. So the nations here built permanent settlements, engaged in horticulture, and would venture onto the plains only seasonally. And so a warfare for control of these bison hunting grounds becomes key to the state of affairs in Native America. Now, this map is a little bit more familiar to you. This shows the United States at around 1850. So this is a nice little neat little map. You see the boundary with British North America or Canada in a neat straight line. You've got the boundary with Mexico to the south. We conquered, of course, Texas won its independence, and then it was absorbed by the United States. A large portion of Mexico was conquered by the U.S., and you have these very neat lines that shows the United States running by 1850 from coast to coast. But there was a huge difference. This is as defined by the European world system that the U.S. was a part of, that they've got their own idea of what boundaries are. They've got their own ideas on how you acquire control of territory and what that means, what sovereignty is. And so they had wars with their neighbors, the U.S. did at the time, the Americans did at the time. They made treaty agreements with their neighbors, and they drew up these boundaries, and yet it was a very different thing from the human reality. This shows the actual population density in 1850. And it shows how the reality of where Americans lived is very different from that map. And this is where we really see the interaction between the native world system and the European world system as represented by the United States. Now, in this map, we see some important things, which is there's this boundary of settlement that you can clearly see the western boundary of Missouri, of Arkansas, and of settlement in Texas. There is a general belief in the United States that the Great Plains, again, because it's so hard to extract those resources, that grassland is so bare and sparse, it's so resistant to settlement, that this is just a great desert. And yet, what do we have? We have a settlement on the Pacific Ocean. Why? Because gold was discovered in California, and an astonishing migration of people went across the Great Plains as well as through Central America and by sea and around South America. And so you have this settled boundary which stops at the edge of the Great Plains, and then you have these peoples actually staking out, migrants staking out new settlements out in California. By 1850, San Francisco is a city of about 50,000 people. They have opera companies that are coming and performing. It takes them a month to get there from New York, but they're performing in California in this vast space. And so what happens? People of the United States are crossing the Great Plains. And that crossing, as we'll see, becomes a problem. It's going to lead to conflict. So you have the Great Migration to Oregon in 1843 and in later years as the Oregon Trail is opened up. You have the migration, of course, to California and the Gold Rush. And later on, there are other gold rushes that carry people from the United States across the Great Plains. And that crossing itself, before we get to the point of occupation, that crossing is going to lead to conflict. Now, I'm beginning to stray over into the story of Custer, away from the background of the Oglalas and the Pawnee Killer and the Cheyennes, his allies. If we are going to understand Custer's path to this moment, this meeting in Nebraska, we have to understand that the conflict that defined his life and that defined American history to this day was centered initially upon Kansas and Nebraska. This is the great struggle over slavery. Now, of course, the struggle is not over whether to abolish slavery, but whether it should be expanded or not. And this is key to understanding the great political debate that leads to the Civil War. Is that the Republican Party, which emerges after the events I'm about to talk about, and many in the North are not abolitionists. They are opposed to expanding slavery into Western territories. That Western movement is so key to the American ideal of getting land for farmers and expanding and getting a piece of this continent for yourself is so key. And yet the question is it going to be a free labor West like the North, or is it going to allow for slavery as it reigns in the South? Now remember, the South at this time is actually the richest. If you look at the white South, it's actually the richest part of the country per capita. That the investment in slaves in 1860 is larger than the total investment in railroads and manufacturing in the United States. So the slave-owning South isn't on the defensive, it's on the aggressive foot. And it sees no reason why it shouldn't be allowed to carry this human property into the West. Stephen Douglas is a senator from Illinois in the 1850s, and California and the connection to California becomes a major national issue. Congress begins debating possible routes for a transcontinental railroad. Again, the idea of crossing. And he wants to give Chicago an advantage. It will have an advantage if settlers move into the unorganized territory west of Iowa and Missouri. In other words, Kansas and Nebraska. But in order to placate Southerners, especially Missourians, where there aren't many slaves, but where slavery is a very important part of the economy, second most valuable form of property after land, they want the territory next to them to be slave territory also. And so in order to get this settlement through Congress, Douglas breaks with the Missouri Compromise, and he secures in the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 the idea of popular sovereignty. Whether the slavery will be allowed in new territories will be up to the settlers. They can vote on it. Well, this leads to basically a civil war. From the North, people rush into Kansas and Nebraska hoping to settle it and fill it with free soil settlers to make it a part of the great free soil system and stop slavery in its tracks. In the South, there's a different attitude. Senator David Rice Akeson of Missouri said in 1854, and he was one of the great pro-slavery ideologues, "We are playing for a mighty stake. If we win, we carry slavery to the Pacific Ocean." So it's not just about the Great Plains. The Great Plains is the first point in a great battle. "We are organizing to meet there, the abolitionists' organization. We will be compelled to shoot, burn, and hang, but the thing will soon be over." Well, you know what? It wasn't over very soon. Bleeding Kansas, because Kansas was immediately next to Missouri, more directly than Nebraska, that was the focus of the pro-slavery forces. And a civil war broke out there in the 1850s. We call it Bleeding Kansas. 200 people died. As an after effect of this, this is a great decisive moment in leading to the Civil War. This is the first outbreak of bloodshed over slavery, and it occurs just south of where we are now in Kansas. And people are moving into where we are now out of a desire to make this free territory. This is actually the center of where the conflict in the Civil War started. It was a fight for the West. Now, when Lincoln was elected, the South seceded, Civil War erupted, and yet the conflict that began on the Great Plains also consumed Missouri, that neighboring state. And a vicious guerrilla war erupted in Missouri that had, in part, the character of a border war with Kansas. And in this guerrilla warfare, which, again, was mainly a civil war within Missouri between Confederate guerrillas and Union forces, mostly Missourians, the Confederates, many of them had been border ruffians who had invaded Kansas in the 1850s to put slavery there. And during this war, a large group of Confederate guerrillas crossed onto the Great Plains, went to Lawrence, Kansas, to attack it because it was the capital of the abolitionist movement in Kansas. And they murdered 200 men and boys, as many people as died in the entire Bleeding Kansas episode. And they burned the town to the ground. Well, naturally, there was a federal response. 3.5 counties that bordered Kansas within Missouri were ordered depopulated in the Civil War by the federal government, by the U.S. Army. And they were ordered out because this was a hotbed of the secessionist guerrillas of Missouri. This had many profound consequences for the region as well as for Missouri, the viciousness of the Civil War in which many civilians were killed. One result is that the families of many prominent Confederate guerrillas were banished from the state. So, for example, Jesse James and his brother Frank James, they were Confederate guerrillas. They're from a slave-owning family in Clay County, which is basically a stone's throw from the Kansas border. They had taken part in a vicious massacre in the Civil War at Centralia, and Frank had taken part in the Lawrence Massacre. So the Union Provost Marshal in their home county ordered their family banished from the state. By early 1865, when they were banished, the front line was too far to send them into the Confederacy, and so Jesse and Frank James's mother and her family, including their younger siblings, were banished to Nebraska, which to her was about the worst possible fate she could imagine. And I think that's actually a compliment to Nebraska. No offense to the James younger fans in the audience. Jesse James was actually wounded a month after General Lee's surrender by in a confrontation with a Wisconsin cavalry patrol in Missouri, shot through the lungs, and he came to Nebraska to help recover from it until his family was finally allowed in late 1865 to return to Missouri. So, in other words, even though the center of this conflict is in Kansas and in Missouri, you know, Nebraska is very much a part of this. The Great Plains are what's at stake, and the fight over the Great Plains is what leads to this vicious conflict. And then it flows back into the Great Plains after the Civil War. So many of these Missouri guerrillas, they're called bushwhackers, many of them went on and it led lives as criminals, not only in Missouri, but in Texas, where they spent the winter, and on the Great Plains. Jesse James liked to rob things inside Kansas, not being a big fan of Kansas. And also, on the other side as well, we see people coming out of the Missouri conflict. Wild Bill Hickok, who earned his reputation as a Union scout and a lawman, as a expert pistol shot. He began his armed career as a Union scout in Missouri. And he took part in the first classic Main Street walkdown against Dave Tutt, in which they faced off at each other on the main street of town with their hand ready to pull their pistols, walked toward each other, and they both threw. Tutt missed, Hickok didn't. That took place not in the Great Plains, but in Springfield, Missouri. Dave Tutt was a former Confederate guerrilla, and Hickok had been a Union scout. And so even on the Union's, even on the lawman side and on the Union side, we see the way this conflict that got started even before the war flowed back out onto the plains from the Civil War. Now, the end of the war, and then this leads, as I said, there's a historian called named Richard Maxwell Brown, who was a great mentor to me, who looks at all these conflicts, like the ones that Wild Bill Hickok was involved in, on the Great Plains, and he sees what he calls a Western Civil War of Incorporation, as the West, the frontier, and the Great Plains, and the Southwest, as they were incorporated into American society. There were people who resisted, who were often had personal or family background and allegiance to the Confederacy, and people who were in favor of that incorporation, of nationalizing, making a part of the nation, the West, and they had tended to be identified with the Union. Wild Bill Hickok is a classic example of that. Now, after the Civil War, Custer has graduated from West Point in 1861. He went off to fight in the Eastern Theater in Virginia. Through luck and through personal merit, he was elevated to be a brigadier general of U.S. volunteers at the age of 23 in 1863. And he goes on to have an extremely successful career as a cavalry commander in the Eastern Theater. He earns his reputation as a great soldier. He, in fact, was a very good combat commander. And soon he will arrive on the Great Plains. So what's going on in the Great Plains? Well, you've got settlement that's going on close to the Missouri River, in eastern Nebraska and in eastern Kansas. And this is, as Richard White says, one of the great success stories of the plans for developing the West, that these eastern regions where there's better rainfall, where there's better farming in the mode of the lands in the settled east, this is a very successful development. The question is, what about the western half of these states, the high plains? Well, the main federal priority was we have to get across them. And it's developing those crossing routes that's important and protecting them. So you've got these wagon trains. You've got railroad crews from Union Pacific and also from the Kansas Pacific building across Kansas. And how are they getting west? Well, they're going where there's water and where there's timber. They're following the rivers that basically go east-west across the Great Plains. These river bottoms are only 7% of the land area of the High Plains, and yet they're absolutely critical to the survival of the nomadic lifestyle and economy of the High Plains peoples. Now, by 1840, these nations of the High Plains, the Lakotas, the Cheyennes, the Comanches, and others, they've actually made peace with each other, and they're great allies in warring against the nations that lived where we are now and also those of the West. But their lifestyle is actually very fragile. This economy depends on both bison herds and horse herds surviving the winter when snow covers the grass, or at least it did then, snow covers the grass, and in which they need water and they need grazing. And so the grazing animals could eat cottonwood bark. They've got timber for fires. They've got water in the river bottoms. And so those narrow strips of rivers are key to the survival of their nations. But what happens? The migrants move through. Simply by passing through, they're degrading this critical resource. They're cutting down timber, they're destroying the grazing, they're churning up the water. When the army in the 1850s builds posts to protect migrants, what are they doing? They're going to the most resource-rich spots. And so these lush areas where there's lots of timber, where there's plenty of grazing, where there's nice water holes, these become deserts because the troops are occupying them year-round. And the migrants would camp next to them. And so they cut down all the timber. They chew up all the grazing. These resource-rich spots become deserts. Now, this makes the bison herds more vulnerable to predators, to other problems. Their populations become more unstable. And the horse herds are also having trouble surviving the winters. And so in the 1860s, as the army marches onto the plains, in 1867, led in a great expedition by Major General Winfield Scott Hancock, who sent out in order to intimidate the High Plains people so they won't wage war on the U.S. And his mission is to say to them, you've got to let our people through. That's all we're doing is passing through. And they have fascinating conversations because they don't get what the High Plains peoples are telling them. So, for example, there is a Kiowa leader, one of the allies of the major nations, larger nations, Satanta, who says to Hancock, all tribes, meaning all those High Plains nations, are my brothers. This country here is old, and it all belongs to them. But you are cutting off the timber, and now the country is of no account at all. Other tribes are foolish. They make war and are unfortunate, and then call upon the Kiowas to aid them. And I don't know what to think. And it's a fascinating moment where he's explaining exactly what's going on. Simply by crossing, you are making our nations, our lifestyle, our economy, untenable. And at the same time, I recognize your military power. And so I'm obliged to side with my allies, and yet I know it's disastrous. He is saying in very simple words, very complicated and civilization-wide ideas of what's going on in the Great Plains. Exactly because the Great Plains are a region in which the resources are so hard to unlock, and that makes the peoples who live here very vulnerable. Now, what happened is, so they're trying to stop all this movement. They begin to wage battles to stop all of this. But meanwhile, they're also facing locals, especially in Colorado, who are talking about extermination. In 1864, one of the most notorious massacres in American history occurred at Sand Creek in Colorado when U.S. troops attacked a peaceful band of Southern Cheyennes led by a peaceful leader named Black Kettle. And they were they actually had a U.S. flag over their lodges when they attacked. But these U.S. troops were U.S. volunteers. They were Colorado troops. And we read in Colorado newspapers about calls for the outright extermination of Native peoples. So you've got federal policy, but then you've got militant locals who want to wage war against the natives. So this is the dilemma they're in. So Hancock, now we're beginning to get back to that moment I started with, he and Custer and the other troops arrive at a great village of Southern Cheyennes and Oglalas on Pawnee Fork in Kansas. They've been warned not to come. They've been told, please, after Sand Creek, we don't want you anywhere near our village. Hancock, he sees this as insolence. He insists on marching up to the village to intimidate them. They flee. They find the village empty. And so what Hancock does is he does two things. He orders an inventory of all the goods in their village. And it's fascinating. They find, for example, about 272 lodges, they find 243 whetstones. And again, native peoples did not have iron mills. Whetstones, 165 frying pans, 49 coffee mills. So even though they're another civilization on the Great Plains, in a very different environment, very different economy, they are interacting with a world economy. Coffee isn't grown in the U.S. It's a world commodity. And so these native peoples are partaking in a worldwide trade in coffee, even though they're not a part of the U.S. world system. So he does this inventory. Then he orders the village burned to the ground. And so every lodge, that's the product of countless hours hunting, skinning the animals, treating the skins, weaving them together into lodges, finding the lodge poles, building them, and everything is completely destroyed, and it naturally sparks a war. Well, Custer goes off with the cavalry to try to find them. He's unable to. He's misled by false trails. He manages, while getting excited about hunting his first buffalo, he manages to shoot his horse in the head. It's actually one of three horses of his own that he kills that year on the Great Plains. He's going through a great turmoil himself because he's created problems in his marriage, and he really wants to get back to his wife so she doesn't find out about a little affair he's had with her best friend who's there with his wife. So when he finally meets up with Pawnee Killer, the one thing Custer does not want to do is fight. He wants to go back and settle all of his personal business. Pawnee Killer says to him, hey, this is a big misunderstanding. It's those horrible Cheyennes who are fighting you, not us Oglalas. Of course, they're allies. Pawnee Killer knows they're at war. Custer doesn't. And so he says, you know what? I'll bring in my band and we'll surrender, but we need some supplies. So he collects supplies from Custer and says, thank you, see you tomorrow. And of course, he never comes back. Custer then leaves Fort McPherson. He goes off to the headwaters of the Republican River hunting these people who are raiding stage stations, who are ambushing army detachments, who are basically showing the army that in the summer it cannot win on the plains. And Custer once again encounters Pawnee Killer, who attacks his camp. Custer wants to have a parley, and Pawnee Killer rides up and he goes, oh, another misunderstanding. Tell you what, this time you come to our camp, and then you can bring us back with you. So the army saddles up, the cavalry, they ride. The Oglalas ride a little faster. Pretty soon they lose sight of them. After finally giving up and going back to their camp, the cavalry finds that the Oglalas have circled around and looted the camp. I think Pawnee Killer had a really good sense of humor. However, he was also lethal. And, excuse me, I'm skipping ahead, but I'm going to come back. And Custer actually finds that Pawnee Killer has ambushed a detachment that was carrying orders for him from Fort Sedgwick, from General Sherman, and that a dozen men have been killed, and he finds out just how lethal warfare on the Great Plains can be. This, again, was drawn by a witness, the artist Theodore Davis, for Harper's Weekly. And the scene was so gruesome with the ritual dismemberment and disfiguring of the bodies that when he published this in Harper's Weekly, he actually rendered the men as skeletons because they didn't think the audience could take it. Now, I want to allow time for questions, so I want to keep going. But I want to note also that the result of the Civil War, as America wages this great conflict over Reconstruction, that Custer and his family represent this on the Great Plains. This is not just a story in the South. And so, for example, at Fort Riley in Kansas, which was the 7th Cavalry's base that Custer left, he left behind his wife and his cook, really his household manager. His wife was Libby Custer, a very well-educated woman. His household manager was Eliza Brown, who had been a slave in Virginia, who had escaped, and who Custer had hired, and who really became a dominant figure in his household. And Libby found out that when the 7th Cavalry left, a black regiment moved in. And again, we have to remember that, yes, this was segregation, but it actually was the black regiments, the Buffalo Soldiers, were created as a way of forcing the Army to take black troops. They said, you have to set aside these regiments for black enlisted men. It was a way of Congress recognizing that after emancipation, with the passage of the 14th Amendment especially, that the black man was an equal citizen with the white man. Now, of course, in practice, that was overcome within about 10 years, and yet Congress acted in the West, where most of the black troops are deployed. It acted to show the results and to bring Reconstruction out onto the West. And this was a very interesting moment because Libby was very distressed about her husband and the problems they were having. And then that distress manifested itself in really a racial fear. She was terrified of these black men who occupied the fort all around her. And she actually relied on Eliza Brown as her protector, who was about this tall and was about 20 years old. Even though her brother-in-law, Tom Custer, who won 2 medals of honor in the Civil War, was living in the same house with them. So Libby was not comfortable with the new world that was emerging, and neither was Custer himself. But Reconstruction really was also a story in the West, where the federal government played such a large role and where it deployed so many of the black troops that played a key part in the frontier army. Now, as I said, this was a moment when Custer basically gave up. So while Libby is back at Fort Riley, and then she comes to Fort Hays to try to find him with Eliza Brown, Custer gives up. And he's desperate to save his marriage. He leaves his men in the field, takes a large escort, returns to find Libby. He finds her back in home base in Kansas, rides hundreds of miles. The army is very upset by this. He is court-martialed and convicted, which now would end a career. Back then, he got a year suspension for this and many other crimes that he had committed. So when Custer had a chance to come back a year later, he was desperate to prove himself. And he takes part in the next phase of wars in the plains. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, even though it's a key part of the book. Custer leads an attack on a southern Cheyenne village at the Washita in 1868, which ironically turned out to be the village led by Black Kettle, the key war leader. And Black Kettle dies in that attack. And it's a very controversial battle. Women and children die, and Custer is ordered, he's ordered to bring back no fighting age men alive, and he doesn't. So there is an atrocity there. He tried to save the women and children, but he makes sure that they have no male prisoners. And yet this battle, as much as it's controversial, it played a key role in basically bringing hostilities in the Central Plains to an end. Custer went out on another attack, attempt to catch the remaining Southern Cheyennes. He actually encountered them in the Texas Panhandle, but this time he took hostages rather than attack. So Custer, ironically, through his creative approach to getting control of this village, showed that his earlier attack wasn't even necessary. And yet, Custer really represents the mainstream of what the army was doing. It was ordered to get control of populations, and that's what Custer did. But again, it's a war which was sparked by mishandling by the army, but also by movement, and only at the very end by the advance of settlement. There's many more details I'm not going to get into. So with the end of fighting in Kansas and in Nebraska, the decline of fighting, Custer really begins to play a role in turning the West into the mythologized, or the Great Plains rather, into the mythologized emblem of all of the West, of the frontier experience. And so he cultivates this appearance. He wears this buckskin outfit that you saw in the other sketch as well. He leads celebrity hunting parties. Since there's not much fighting to be done, he leads hunting parties of celebrities out on the Great Plains to hunt the few remaining buffalo. He's brought in by General Sheridan to be a star when the Grand Duke Alexis of Russia comes, and they go out in Nebraska in 1870 on a grand hunting expedition.
And then Custer has this photo of himself taken. He's in a tuxedo with his fur cap from his hunting expeditions in the Great Plains. And this says a lot about Custer. He wants to use his new Western reputation to rehabilitate himself in the East and also to make money. So he actually goes for about 2 years. He takes leave from the Army for almost a year, I should say. And he goes to New York. And there he tries to float shares in a silver mining company he started. And the financiers of New York on Wall Street talk about, oh, Custer knows what he's doing. He's from the West. And so that tuxedo with that fur cap, that symbolizes what Custer is trying to do and what's happening in the West as the new corporate economy is embracing this lightly populated territory and integrating it into the new industrial economy. And Custer actually comes back to the West in 1873 and plays a key role in setting the stage for the final conflict on the Great Plains, culminating in the Great Sioux War of 1876. And what happens is that his first assignment is to be with a survey party of the Northern Pacific, one of the second wave of transcontinental railroads. And this goes through Lakota territory, and he actually has two battles with the Lakotas, in which at least one of which we know that Sitting Bull was a leader on the other side. And ironically, considering the way he died against these very same peoples, he actually performs quite well. He performs with discretion, he performs with keen judgment as well as bravery, and he keeps his men together, he suffers no disaster, he drives off their attackers in the end, and it again burnishes his reputation as an Indian fighter at a time when many in the Army see him as a problem officer. But again, for us, thinking about the Great Plains, this is a story about the United States grappling with crossing the Great Plains. And that railroad is running right through the Yellowstone Basin, a key resource area for the Lakotas to the north of here. And Sitting Bull is opposing them because of the environmental threat that this represents. But this is also a moment when federal policy and also Wall Street are coming together. The transcontinental railroads weren't just businesses. They were kind of a mercantilist corporation, the Transcontinentals, in their early days, in which the government, it federally chartered UP, and it played a key role in subsidizing and promoting these transcontinental railroads, which regular railroad men were not very interested in. You know, one railroad journal said that a railroad 100 miles long east of the Mississippi River would give more traffic to Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York railroads than the entire length of the Transcontinental Railroad. So again, this is a federal project to build transcontinental railroads in which they're enlisting the business figures. And it makes it very unstable. And this plays a role, actually, this instability, the opposition of Native people, plays a role in bringing down the entire economy in 1873. Because one of the key financiers of the day, Jay Cook, is the main man behind the Northern Pacific. And, you know, the stock market's beginning to stall. The railroad is running into trouble, opposition from natives. He's putting out his own money to keep the company going. And in 1873, he can't do it anymore. He fails. And it brings down all of Wall Street, and it brings down the entire U.S. economy. And so the U.S. goes into a Great Depression. That's what they called it before 1929 surpassed it. A Great Depression, which finds its center in the meeting ground between Native people, federal policy, business interests, and that attempt to cross this great landscape of the Great Plains. So again, key moments in American history, which are shaped by the Great Plains and by the particular conditions and peoples here. Now, you know, moving on, we get out of the Indian era, and we begin to look at Nebraska into the late 19th century and the Great Plains. And again, we have that contrast between eastern Nebraska and western Nebraska. This idea of being a farmer, of owning a piece of the land, of being independent, is key to the American ideal of ourselves. And yet, those high plains are still resistant to human settlement. And so there's a few wet years when people are really able to grow, you know, eastern crops, corn and whatnot, and wheat, out in western Nebraska, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, on the high plains. And you see in 1900, there's more settlement now west of that 100th meridian. And yet, by the time we get to the 21st century, we see that that settlement, to a certain extent, has receded. That the arid environment, the attempt to impose on the high plains a agricultural economy based on very different terrain fails. And so most of the homesteads that are claimed west of the 100th meridian fail. Most, even the ranchers, they go crazy in the 1880s, and there's a great die-off when, again, the harsh environment of the high plains kills off most of the cattle herds on the high plains. And one of the victims of that, by the way, is Theodore Roosevelt, whose herds up in North Dakota die off in the harsh winters of the mid-1880s. And so, again, the nature of the Great Plains, it has an effect on the line of settlement, on the nature of agriculture, on where people are settling, and on the nature of the plains. And yet, this sense of Nebraska and of the Plains states as being agricultural states that are cut off from the East, that are misunderstood by the East, this plays a role in the last figure I want to talk about, William Jennings Bryan. Now, William Jennings Bryan is known for giving the Cross of Gold speech, and that's pretty much what everybody forgets. At that point, they forget. What they don't realize is that his career is built on a sense that the system is rigged against people in the interior, against rural people. And I won't go into too many details, but this has a real reality in the nature of the national bank system erected in the Civil War, that there was this imbalance in literally just the amount of money you had to transact business. So there are parts of the country where people literally didn't have enough cash to conduct business, in which they're suffering deflation. Prices are falling every year because of the lack of currency, and it's all concentrated in the bank-rich areas in the Northeast. At the same time, new mechanization is making it much easier to produce wheat. So in the 19th century, we see the price of wheat basically collapses by half from 1840 to 1880, a little less than half, but close. So wheat is getting cheaper to produce. It's getting cheaper in the marketplace, too, at a time when prices are falling. And so farmers are really desperate, and they feel like it's a regional issue between Nebraska and the Plain States and the Northeast. And so this gives rise to Bryan's career. And I just want to quote a little bit from that, close out with that Cross of Gold speech, because the whole business about whether silver should be made into money, the silver movement, bimetallism, these are all technical issues. But they're rooted in this idea that there's an imbalance between the center, where the forgotten man is, and the cosmopolitan, the center of the country, the remote parts of U.S. civilization, and the cosmopolitan center in the Northeast. He says that the merchant at the Crossroads store, he said in 1896, is as much a businessman as the merchant of New York. The farmer who goes forth in the morning and toils all day creates as much wealth as a businessman who goes on the Board of Trade and bets on the price of grain. This is almost something that could have come out of the last few elections. And then he says, "Ah, my friends, we say not one word against those who live upon the Atlantic coast, but the hardy pioneers who have braved all the dangers of the wilderness, who have made the desert to bloom as the rose, pioneers away out there," pointing to the west, "who rear their children near nature's heart, these people, we say, are as deserving of the consideration of our party," because this was at a party convention in Chicago, "as any people in the country." And then he goes on and he says something that's very interesting. He says there's two ideas of government. Those who believe that if you will only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperity will leak through on those below. One might even say trickle down. That's me. The democratic idea, however, has been that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up to every class that rests upon them. Now, Richard White, in his new book, The Republic for Which It Stands, notes that that actually wasn't the democratic idea, that William Jennings Bryan is fighting to make that the democratic idea. Now, my point here is not to say, oh, William Jennings Bryan is a great American hero, or to take any position on current political arguments. The point is, these are words that sound very familiar and actually depending on the words, on both sides of the political division today. And so we see here in Nebraska the sense of this region being discriminated against by the nature of the financial system. We see the very words in which we argue about politics today are beginning to be formed, in which ideas which people have as their basic principles of politics are beginning to be formed. And again, why? Because of the nature of the landscape, because of the nature of the history that brought people here last to this place that was between empires, between civilizations, where world systems overlapped, where people had to confront, sometimes in the most violent way, what they believed, and in the end, what they believe about what the United States is all about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, TJ, very much. I'm Will Thomas. I'm the Engle Professor in the Humanities at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and I have the pleasure of moderating some questions and answers from you all for Mr. Stiles. How is the legacy of Plains violence now defining struggles over resources, water, coal, oil, etc., in today's, quote, flyover region, end quote?
Well, you know, again, this is a difficult point because rather than try to make some statement about current policy, let me just say, or current conflicts, let me just say that we see, again, due to the nature of geography, a lot of the same framework of things that are going on. So you have people who live in local regions who want to exploit the resources there and, you know, build their livelihoods on it. But then you also see the fact that, and part of that livelihood, again, in Nebraska, is as a crossing ground. So pipelines are obviously a big issue, and it's not oil extraction in Nebraska in that case. It's bringing it across, you know, across this great region, just like you got migrants to Oregon in the 1840s. The crossing is the conflict. But the repercussions of having to cross that space are national. And even global. I mean, I was just talking to the people from the UP before, I still have a 19th century, I say the UP, UP before the event tonight, and they were talking about dealing with foreign customers and how it's a global business. And, you know, all of these questions now have global repercussions, whether it's business, environment, trade, agriculture, everything is, you know, it's a global context. And so, you have both people who naturally want outsiders not to meddle in it, and you also have people who say legitimately we're all affected by all of these decisions. And that was true in the 19th century and even before.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 22nd Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today's guest speaker has been American biographer T.J. Stiles, author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jesse James, The Last Rebel of the Civil War, and, most recently, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. He spoke on the topic, It Happened Here, Why National Conflicts Have Centered on the Great Plains. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 3, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Christopher Summerick, Executive Director of Humanities Nebraska, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.